Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, June the 26th. And with the music of my good friend Carlos Guedes, we get another podcast underway. You know, there are, my late mother used to say that there are Cubans everywhere. And it was her way of saying that you can run into a Cuban just about everywhere you go. And obviously, whether you're talking about Miami, obviously, or the United States, I mean, the number of times that I have been waiting for a plane or standing next to somebody on a, you know, or do a business call and find out that the person I'm calling on is the son of a Cuban immigrant or whatever. So Cubans are everywhere. And today, and we've spoken to many of them in lots of different places. And today we're going to speak to someone in Japan, if you can believe that. Yes, there's Cubans in Japan, lots of them. Lots of them, and they're very patriotic and good Cubans, and I'm sure they enjoy Cuban food as much as all of us do. Before we get to our guest, though, I just want to take a minute and, again, send our love and sympathies to the people of Miami for this terrible building collapse. I just learned this morning that a friend of a friend was killed in this terrible tragedy, a gentleman and his wife and their son. Just unfortunately, are part of the casualties. There are others as well, and we've seen some of their photos on. Well, so far there are more missing than dead, but you know you hope for the best. But it actually, you know, it doesn't look real good when you're down there in the rubble for several days. That's probably not a good sign. So our best to the people of Miami, the good people down there, and I'm sure they'll put it together. They have good leadership in that city, and I'm sure they'll put it together. But what a tragedy, what a terrible tragedy, what happened in Miami. Well, let's get going here, and let's say hello to our friend Jonathan Richardson. How are you, Jonathan?
Hi there, Silvio. Doing great.
All right. All the way from Tokyo. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here, Central Time, Texas. What time is it in Tokyo?
Right now.
So we're 12 hours difference. Yeah, 12 hours.
Yeah.
Wow. 10:03 p.m., of course. So you're...
10:03 p.m.
That's right. You're almost going to bed here pretty soon.
That's pretty much what's going on. Yep.
Yes. Now, tell me something. I mentioned before we get to our conversation, I mentioned the terrible incident in Miami, the building collapse. I don't know anybody personally. Or even a close friend. I just heard about friends of friends. Do you have any, do you know anybody who was involved there or maybe friend of a friend? Have you heard anything?
I mean, no, thanks be to God. My family, all my family and friends and acquaintances are safe. I definitely feel for the people who are there. But no, it's a terrible tragedy. Yeah, it's very, very sad.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it right now. I'm looking at a photo of it right now, and the building looks like something you would see in Beirut or something like that. You know, not, you know, almost, you know. I know that it wasn't a terrorist attack, but it sure looks that way when you see the building. Well, let's talk about Cubans in Japan because this is fascinating topic. But let's begin with you. Just give me a little biography and how you got to Japan.
Okay, sure. Well, I came to Japan in the spring of 2014. I was on a kind of sabbatical or kind of pre-studies break. I took about a month to spend some time here to get ready for graduate studies. And I was visiting a friend and really fell in love with the place. And I decided, instead of going to the other school that I originally planned to go to for my graduate studies, I chose Tokyo. So I've been here since the fall. I came back in the fall. I've been here since the fall of 2014 and haven't left. So it's been great. I ended up studying here at the Catholic University in Tokyo. Jesuits run a school called Sophia. I ended up studying under a political sciences human rights specialist on North Korea. I was focused on a kind of international family law and the human rights issues around that. But alongside that, I was also studying the Cubans here in Japan as part of my courses on social movements and global migration. So
great.
Yeah.
So how, maybe you said it and I missed it. So you were in Miami, right? Grew up in Miami, right?
Oh, yeah. So I'm originally from Hialeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm a Miami native, Miami born and raised. So yeah, I've lived a couple of places, but Miami's been home. And, I have my family still back there.
Yeah.
So I'd definitely say I'm a Miami native.
So when you told your family you were going to Japan, they probably said, what?
Yeah, no, of course. What are you crazy? Are you crazy? What are you go to the other side of the world?
Or if you're like, if I had said that to my mom, she would have said, what's her name?
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
She would have said, what girl have you met in Japan that takes you there? That's what I think a lot of Cuban mothers would say, don't you think?
That probably was something that ran through my mom's mind. she knew that I was over there for a good month and, probably a bit suspicious, like, why are you over there for so long? And then I decided to go. No, I mean, my family was surprised that I was heading out, but at the same time quite excited. I don't know. There's a lot of interest, I think, in the Cuban community, for the world in general. We're a diaspora people. So
absolutely. No, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. There are Cubans, as I mentioned in my introduction, that, whenever I would tell my mom that I talked to a Cuban, in Europe or whatever, or wherever, she would always say the same thing. There's Cubans everywhere. Estamos, she would say, had a great phrase that she would use. Estamos regados por todo el mundo, which is sort of the translation to that is loosely, we're spread out all over the world. That's kind of the translation. But so tell me about, being Cuban. You live in Tokyo, right, in the Tokyo metropolitan area, right?
Yes, I live in the Tokyo metropolitan area.
And right, that is a population of how much?
I really couldn't tell you the general population of Tokyo right now, including foreign residents. I mean, the census that was done recently. I'm sure the stats are out, but I haven't looked into them. So,
20 million, maybe? 20 million?
Probably so. I think the city is comparable to Miami or probably Houston. So it's a rather large and populous city. And we have a lot of inflow of immigrants, migrants rather, who are here for work temporarily.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, tell me a little bit about when you get to Tokyo, you get to Japan. And how quickly did you meet a Cuban?
I kind of went, it's crazy. It sounds crazy, I know, but like the first week that I was here on vacation, you can take a Miami Cuban out of Miami, but it stays with you. You always search for a little piece of home everywhere. And I sought out what I saw was a Cuban restaurant in the the main part of Roppongi, which is a kind of party district here. And I didn't meet a Cuban, but I met some Peruvians who were making Cuban food. And later on when I came back, the first time I met a Cuban was probably when I came in the fall, in kind of late fall. I was feeling homesick and sorting out Cuban things. I met a Japanese who'd been raised in Cuba. So that was then around that time I also met a Cuban person. Yes.
Okay. And you have a group of Cubans right there in the Tokyo area, Tokyo, Japan area. So do you get together? I mean, do you get together much? I mean, do you like tell me about the organization? Is it a you know, an organization with a lot of structure, or is it just, you know, a bunch of guys and Cubans who get together, you know, from time to time and go eat some Cuban food at somebody's home or go out to eat? Tell me about the group that you have there, please.
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, maybe start. I'll start with its origins or kind of how we got together. You know, After that experience at the restaurant and meeting that Cuban Japanese person, one of the things that hit me was that the person that I'd met there was rather sympathetic to the Castro regime, and in fact had, you know, does work with the government in you know, various ways, and was adamant, you know, in a friendly way, but kind of adamant that I was taught something wrong. So I knew that couldn't be the case, and I knew that if I'd met other Cubans here in Japan, maybe, you know, there might be a group, you know, who feels the same way, you know, that the exile community in general does, right, about that. So I started a Facebook group called Cubanos en Japón. Actually, it's called Cubanos en Nihon, and the last two words are in Japanese characters. And we got together little by little. I met people through that, through kind of sending out invites. I also joined another group that they had and that was already here called Cubanos en Japón, spelled out in Spanish. And I found out that the Cuban embassy had put together some years ago a group of residents. I think it's called La Asociación Cubana de Japón, something like that, José Martí Cubana de Japón. And this group kind of totes the embassy lines. So when the embassy wants to shout divisive and angry things about America or blockade or what have you, they do. They follow them. And I thought this is really crazy. You know, there has to be an outlet for people who are not a part of that. And little by little, I went meeting these people. and the research that I was doing, I found out that there were around 74 or so, according to the census of Cubans in my area. And this was back in 2017 or so when I was looking at this information. And then the numbers have gone up, but there are about 70 to 80 something of us here in Tokyo. The numbers, of course, fluctuating for coronavirus. And a good about maybe 15 to 20 people I'm in contact with and I know quite well. People meet each other. We don't always get together, especially right now during the COVID situation. But people sometimes meet each other, meet each other at their establishments. Many people are involved in dance. Many people are involved in running restaurants or running bars. So they often meet at these places or sometimes going out with the families. All the families get together mm-hmm. and go out. That community is really concerned about kind of the voice that the embassy is putting out
right.
For Cubans, you know, which lies about the regime. It says all these wonderful things. And what they'd like to do, you know, is build solidarity with each other and let each other know, especially in these last few years, that it's okay to be here, to be vocal, and to oppose the regime in wherever you are, you know, abroad. Right. But most of them are not exiles. Most of them are residents who hold Cuban passports, and a rather brave group of people. So I've been honored to be a part of that group.
Yeah, I think
we're trying to.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead and finish.
We're trying to, together, we have already something of an unofficial organization formed, and we will have an official organization formed to kind of further the cause.
Right.
But there are many Cubans here, well-established, who are conscientious about raising their voices now.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, you have the same challenge. I mean, you in Japan have the same challenge that other Cubans have in other countries, because most countries, of course, European countries, Asian countries, you know, maintained or have diplomatic relations with Cuba. So there's an embassy there, and, you know, obviously the Cuban government tries to use that embassy to promote itself. And you know, I guess there's nothing you can do about that, but, you know, usually when I talk to other people around the world who are familiar with Cuba or who live, like, let's say, in Germany or England or whatever, I always remind them that the embargo, I think, is one of the most misunderstood things, one of the most misunderstood things in the world. I mean, the embargo came about because the Cuban government, this is back in 62, I guess, the embargo came about because President Kennedy wanted to punish the Cuban government for expropriating U.S. property in Cuba and without compensating the investors or the owners. And it wasn't just big companies. You know, it wasn't just Texaco and AT&T and companies like that or the electric company. A lot of companies with American owners were expropriated without compensation. And one of them, for example, was the company that my uncle used to work for in Sabana La Grande, where my father's family's from. And this was a small business, a small manufacturing operation in that town owned by an American man and his wife. They lived in the town. They were good town people. They took very good care of the employees. They were good citizens in that town. And their business was expropriated for no other reason than because they were Americans. And, you know, so that's what the embargo is all about. A lot of times people don't really understand what the embargo was about. Then it was codified, or it was made tougher in 1996 when you had the incident of, you know, the airplanes, you know, the Hermanos al Rescate, you know, Brothers to the Rescue airplane that was shot down by the Cuban government. But, I mean, that's the story of the embargo. But the last point I want to make is that the embargo does not stop any country from doing business with Cuba. Japan does business with Cuba. Mexico does business with Cuba. So the problem is not the embargo. The problem, it's a combination of things. Cuba is a very small market, frankly, for, you know, there's not a lot they can buy in Cuba. And the other reason, of course, is that Cuba always has a cash problem. So they keep, you know, restructuring their debts. So, you know, Cuba has had to restructure their foreign debt several times because they just don't have the local economy to generate the kind of business activity or wealth that most countries do. I mean, so that's kind of a long-winded, you know, little speech here, but I just wanted to put that on the table because whenever I talk to somebody who wonders about the embargo, I always explain those things to them. And then all of a sudden, if they're reasonable people, obviously, if they're not reasonable people, they're not going to listen. But if they're reasonable people, they'll go, oh, okay, really? That's a different explanation of the embargo than I thought it was. So I just wanted to bring that, Jonathan, just to tell you how I deal with it, Jonathan.
Oh yeah, and that's really speaking to the truth of it. Yeah, a lot of people are not really that informed about the situation, and they think it's a kind of predatory thing. You know, the big United States against a small humanitarian nation of Castro's Cuba. So it's a big propaganda job that's done on the part of the regime.
Exactly.
Kind of confuse people about that.
No, you're exactly right. And because, you know, they play on the victim role. They say, well, here's this little country, and the United States is so big. But again, nothing stops Cuba from doing business with Mexico, with Argentina, with Canada, with Spain, France, Germany, Japan, China. I mean, any country that wants to do business with Cuba can do so. The embargo only applies to American companies, but as you know, there's lots of companies around the world, and they make a lot of things, and they're free to sell to Cuba. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because if I was in your shoes, I'd be frustrated all the time having to deal with this, but because it's basically a lie that is being told by the Cuban government, and sadly, too many people pick up on it, Jonathan.
Yes, it's definitely something that it's frustrating. It's just the whole narrative that you know the regime kind of uses to you know parade itself around the world is you know definitely you know a little bit irksome. And one of the reasons why I did my best to find out you know my compatriots, my extended, so to say, family here on the Japanese archipelago, and find others who felt the same. And there are, you know, just like Cubans all around the world, people don't leave such a beautiful island for no reason.
Right.
And this is something that's been said time and time again. So many people do feel this way, do kind of know it. But yeah, the regime over here, the embassy, tends to use Cuban culture as a means to prop up its business.
Right.
And Japan has never cut ties with Cuba. Some countries post the embargo did kind of go along with some U.S. foreign policy and put some sanctions on Cuba or you know, were a little bit harsh in terms of trade. However, Japan didn't do that, despite being a very strong Cold War ally of ours. That's
right.
One of the reasons I wanted to do the research that I was doing here was because Japan, in some ways, is kind of a neutral location because it's our ally. It's the U.S. ally, rather, and also an ally of the Cubans who know what's going on, you know, in being an anti-communist country officially. It's concerned about abuses in North Korea. It's very
right.
concerned about abuses and, you know, bad actors in China and other places. But for some reason, it gets along very well with the regime and has done so since Castro took power.
Right. No, you're right about that. Let's take a little break, Jonathan. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to follow up a little bit more on this point you're making about Japan and Cuba, and then maybe talk a little bit more about the group and maybe some of the things you're doing. We're chatting with Jonathan Richardson all the way from Japan. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, today on the phone with our friend Jonathan Richardson, all the way from Japan. Cubanos in Japan, what a neat idea. Jonathan, welcome back, and thank you so much for being with us today. But I just want to make a point about what you just said, and now you've been studying this a lot, so tell me if I'm right or wrong on my conclusion here. Japan and Cuba probably had a pretty good relationship before Castro, too. And the reason for that is that it was just a diplomatic relationship. There was never really that much trade, to my knowledge, between Cuba and Japan before Castro. And today, there's probably a little bit, but not that much. So I think I understand, in a way, why the Japanese adopted the posture they took. And they say, look, you know, it's not our job to to get involved in this. You know, we just do business with Cuba, whatever government they have. Now, what's interesting, though, the China is a different story, because my father tells me that my father was a banker, and he used to work for a Cuban bank, and their office in Havana was two blocks from the Bank of China office. And the Bank of China was very active in Cuba. And they were active because there were many Chinese Cubans, because many Chinese came to Cuba in the early part of the 20th century, and they were the ones who built the railroads, basically, just like in the United States, just like in Mexico. So, yes, there was a lot of trade, and especially a lot of remittances going back to Japan, to China from Cuban Chinese. And so that was a little different story. But do you agree with me with what I said about Japan, that I think it's just more a relationship of just diplomatic convenience, that they're not necessarily great buddies? They just figured, hey, you know, we're not getting involved in what kind of government they have, Jonathan.
Well, there's definitely some truth to that. Prior to Castro, there was tension between the Batista regime and Japan. Batista, of course, President Batista, in his term as president in Cuba, had gone along with U.S. initiatives to kind of be very concerned about the Japanese residents. And so in the U.S., of course, we had, you know, the unfortunate event of American citizens being detained and being taken from their homes and incarcerated. That also happened for a time in Cuba. So because of that, at least during World War II, there were some tensions. There were some problems between the Cuban government and the Japanese citizenry, as well as Japan. That grudge carried on for a bit. Post-war, there was definitely a thaw, and by the time of the end of the revolution, Cuba had established with Japan most favored nation status, most favored nation relations in terms of trade and diplomatic work. So you're right to say they had a very good relationship at that point, even with Batista at the end. So much so that you had quite loyal members of the Cuban Republic here in Tokyo that later defected, because they had a mission here to Japan at the time. They had, I believe, a full embassy at the time, and some members of the embassy defected to the U.S. And kind of left the embassy to get away from the regime. They were concerned about the change. But yeah, they did have a good relationship. So after the revolution, the Japanese did what you said for those reasons. You know, let's keep the diplomatic niceties and trade, especially sugar. At that time, the U.S. was in possession of the islands of Okinawa. Sugar is very important, and Cuba exported a lot of sugar to Japan. So that was very
interesting. Interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Cuba exported that much sugar to Japan. Obviously, to the United States, of course, the primary customer of Cuban sugar was the United States, but I had no idea of that sugar relationship with Japan. Very, very interesting thing that I've learned from you today. Now, of course, one more thing about Japan. Japan today is extremely influential in two Latin American countries, maybe more, but two in particular, Peru and Brazil. In Brazil, the influence is overwhelming. I mean, you could see it in the business world and in so many other things. And in Peru, well, they had a president recently who was the son of Japanese immigrants, you know, Fujimori, who was president. And his daughter, I believe, just ran for president recently. So those are examples of the Japanese in Latin America. In fact, I got to tell you a funny story about Japanese in Brazil. They've almost taken over the baseball world in Brazil. Of course, Brazil is not known for baseball. You know, it's a soccer country. They're one of the soccer superpowers of the world. So it does not have a baseball tradition like Cuba or the United States or Japan. And it is the Japanese immigrants who basically built up baseball in Brazil. They're the ones who pretty much created the baseball clubs, and they're the ones who basically been playing baseball, the Japanese immigrants and their children born in Brazil. So I always thought that was kind of a funny influence of Japan in Latin America. Were you familiar with that information about the Japanese and baseball in Brazil?
Oh, I had no idea that the Japanese were the ones who kind of got it going there in Brazil. That's great. I can definitely speak to the fact that, yes, the Japanese teams here in the Japanese league does scout Venezuelan and Cuban players.
Sure.
So this is definitely something that's very normal here, and so you have a lot of people who come for that reason.
Well, the way that the Japanese baseball existed in Brazil, we're really talking here about the last 50 years, okay, pretty much after the war, after World War II. But the way that the Japanese sort of revived baseball in Brazil, because there's really no baseball in Brazil, there's no tradition, because the Brazilians just don't play baseball. It's not part of their culture. So these Japanese companies would move to Brazil, and obviously they would bring, you know, their executives and their families and so on. So they had schools. And it was in those schools that the baseball sort of got started. And from there you began to have, you know, industrial leagues. And now it's a pretty big thing if you go down there, the influence of the Japanese. Well, let's get back to the Cubans in Japan for a second. What else would you like to tell me? First of all, I want to say hello to any of your fellow Cubans listening in Japan. I want to say thank you to them for checking out the podcast today. But what else can you tell me about the Cubans in Japan? What else can you tell me that we haven't brought up yet?
So a couple of years ago, 2019 or so, we remember back the Cuban government was heading up a referendum, right, to reform the constitution.
Mm.
There was going to be a convention to reform the constitution. They went about it anyway. You had to vote a yes or no, right, on the referendum, and it was a farce. So the first time that this group kind of publicly united with a common voice to kind of voice their opposition to the government was then. And if you find my Facebook group, our Facebook group, Cubanos en Nihon, or another one, which is their Cubanos Libre en Japón, you'll see a posting from that initial 2019 initiative with very brave people who got together a long declaration against what was the farce of the government, and published it in three different languages, in English, in Spanish, and in Japanese.
Wow.
So that's something that's probably not so known about them.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that there are Japanese, I didn't mention this, but there are, of course, Japanese Cuban people of mixed ancestry who are here, or, you know, who are living in Miami now in exile, who are all aware of these situations as well, and who form, you know, a part of this community. So we're trying little by little to make inroads into the Cuba enthusiasts here in Japan, because there are many. People know Cuba because of salsa. People know Cuba because of the rum and the cigars. That's kind of how the culture is carried here. People, you know, go crazy over Cuban dance and Cuban music. So, you know, in the middle of all of that, the people who are now raising their voices are trying to also inform them and say, hey, you know, this is our culture. This is our music. You know, we love you and you love these things, but this is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I would say that that's one of the things that I'd like to say about this. All of these people are very brave. You know, they have a lot to lose because they're residents with
mm-hmm.
Cuban passports. They're not exiles of other nationality. And yeah, it's been an honor kind of being with them. And also that we have, yeah, mixed Japanese Cubans who hold Japanese nationality or Japanese citizenship and who are also aware of the situation, but we're in the minority.
Right.
This is not a majority.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing because you made a couple of very interesting points. The best thing going for Cuban culture, the reason that Cuban culture is so charming, the reason that people fall in love with Cuba, or the culture, I would say, so rapidly, is the music. Cuban music is just so amazing, and you know, it has a real charm. It has a tremendous history. It is very different than the music from other Latin American countries. Obviously, Cuban music has a lot of African influence, so the combination of the Spanish and the African influence created a Cuban sound that is very unique. And you know, I had the great fortune, of course, of growing up with two parents who would always be playing Cuban music. So I knew all the artists. I knew all the songs. I mean, they were part of growing up in our household, you know. So when I hear performers like Benny Moré or La Orquesta Riverside or Celia Cruz, who was a more recent, you know, was very popular everywhere. Celia Cruz, I mean, has a fan club everywhere in the world. When I hear stuff like that, it reminds me of my parents' turntable because that's where I used to hear it. But there's no question that the Cuban culture, when people hear Cuban music, they immediately fall in love with the Cuban culture. And then when you mix that with a little Cuban food and I guess a little Cuban personality. I think Cubans are charming by nature, so that's, I understand why people fall in love with Cuba everywhere, and hopefully one day soon they can fall in love with a Cuba that is free and democratic, Jonathan.
Amen. Yeah, that's our hope. Like I'm sure your generation and my mom's generation when they were younger, you know, always said next year in La Habana.
So right. And just out of curiosity, you mentioned generations. If I may just ask you, so you were, what decade were you born in Miami, in the 80s or the 70s?
So I was born at the very end of the 80s. I'm 32.
Okay, so you're like one of my sons then. Now, the reason I mention that, the reason I asked you that question, is because one thing about Cubans is we now have, you know, the generation of my parents. My parents, you know, as you remember, my mother passed away recently. That generation, they're the ones who came here. They're the ones who came to the United States and sort of, you know, they met the fire. They were the ones who came here and built this great image that Cubans have. Then I came here as a kid. My sons are like your age. So it's like three generations. You know, you and I are from different generations. My parents, your parents. Your parents are probably closer to my generation. And it's like I'm always fascinated at the way that Cuban generations can be in different places. And yet there's something about us that connects us. And what connects us is this Cuban heritage that we have. Obviously, I'm very proud of the United States. This is a wonderful country. I'm a U.S. citizen. I love the United States. But I love our Cuban roots as well, Jonathan.
Yes, yes. Yes, everything. I mean, it's an amazing thing, the connections that we have. And, of course, firstly, my sincere condolences again for your mom.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
And my, my abuela also recently passed away this year, which was quite difficult. So we want to appreciate, you know, the people that we have with us from the generation that really went through the hardest part of the struggle,
right,
in leaving and experiencing the revolution when they were in their, when they were in their 20s, when they were in their prime, and going through all of it.
Well, their lives were turned upside down. You know, if you had asked my parents in 1959, because I used to speak about this with my parents. My parents said the last thing in the world they thought in 1959 was that they were going to be leaving Cuba, living in another country, namely the United States, or that they would be born in Cuba and eventually be buried outside of Cuba. It's just a fascinating thing. I mean, they had no idea that this was coming, because Cuba was not a country. This is one of the amazing things about Cuba. Cuba was not a country that people left before Castro. In the first 60 years of the 20th century, when Cuba was going through its political struggles, but yet it was succeeding in many ways, Cuba was a place that people moved to. And it was, you know, generations of people from lots of different countries and lots of different places that went to Cuba because they wanted to live there, because they were good opportunities to live there. And that's how you get, you know, I mean, I have a friend of mine who was born in Cuba of Russian parents who moved to Cuba. Cuba had a very large Jewish population because of all of the people who moved to Cuba from, you know, escaping Hitler and all of that. So anyway, it's just the rich history that Cuba has, and that's, I think, what makes all of us so interesting people. Well, Jonathan, we're kind of down to the end here, but any one last thing you want to say?
So I'd just like to say that if you're Cuban anywhere in the world, please don't be afraid to speak up. Right now, the regime is really on its knees.
It is.
Right now, they're doing a very good PR campaign across the world to gain sympathy. Now is the time to be the toughest.
Right.
Now is the time. You know, it's darkest before the dawn. If you're going to oppose the situation in Cuba, do it now.
Right.
Do it now when the regime is telling you all the opposite, because that's when it's going to be meaningful and that's when it's going to work. And all my friends here in Japan and we are very much aware of that. So please do your best wherever you are to stand up for Free Cuba. So it can be, you know, next year in La Habana.
That's right.
Yeah, that's probably the last thing I'd like to say. My friends would certainly like to speak with me sometime if ever possible.
Well, we'll schedule another one, and we'll have some of your friends on the panel too. So that would be great. Just get together with them, and we'll do another one. We'll do another one, and they can join us. They can join us as well. I love to hear from them. I love to hear them from them. But you're exactly right. The regime is in bad shape right now. Obviously, COVID has had a devastating impact on Cuba. I mean, we're humanitarian, so we sympathize for the COVID impact. But the impact has really been on tourism. And on the Cuban economy, and they're in bad shape right now. The Cuban government is in very bad shape. There's great opposition within Cuba, as you know, to the regime. So this is not the time to let down. On the contrary, this is the time to put down your foot and hopefully squeeze them out of power. Jonathan, it was a real pleasure. And you said there's a couple of Facebook pages, right?
Yes, there are a couple of Facebook pages if people would like to follow what we're doing here. One of them is Cubanos and like in Spanish, and then the Japanese characters for Japan. So you look up, you know, Japan, Japanese characters, enter that, Cubanos in Japan, and you'll find it. The other one is Cubanos Libres in Japón,
okay.
Which is another group that we have. So if anyone would like to follow us, there on Facebook, we are there.
All right, great. Well, why don't you, if you can, post the podcast on those two Facebook pages and tell all our Cuban friends in Tokyo and in Japan to follow us that way. And yes, I would love to do a show with several Cubans there and hear from them. That would be absolutely great. Thank you and have a great day and enjoy yourself. I know it's kind of late at night there in Japan. Do you guys eat late, or is it more like the Americans who eat at 6 o'clock?
Oh no, I've kept up my late night merienda eating time. So we eat pretty late in my household, and no worries. You know, I'm a university professor, so I'll just be grading. It's the weekend.
Okay. No, so you got some papers you got to grade. Okay, I understand that. Well, be nice to those students.
No, of course.
Okay. All right. Well, how do you say goodnight in Japanese?
So we'd say oyasumi nasai.
All right. Well, good night from Dallas, and thank you, Jonathan. And actually, I should say good day because it's only 8:30 here or so. But that's something we'll have to coordinate. If we're going to get some of your friends on the podcast, we'll have to coordinate the 12-hour difference. But other than that, I'd love to do the podcast with him anytime, Jonathan, anytime.
Thank you so much, Silvio. It's been a pleasure.
Same here. And keep up the great work. You're doing wonderful work over in Japan.
Adelante.
All right. Thank you so much. Our friend Jonathan Richardson, a couple of Facebook pages there that he mentioned. We'll try to post those on the show and on the show information. Again, just absolutely amazing. As my mother used to say, we're everywhere. Cubans are everywhere. And we are. And we're doing a great job promoting the image of Cuba and the idea that Cuba is still under communist dictatorship and that we have to do our best to make it a free country. We owe that to our parents. We owe that to our parents who did such an amazing job opposing communism in Cuba. Bye-bye, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.